The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Slate Money, our weekly podcast dissecting the world of business and finance. I'm Felix Salmon, the senior editor at Fusion here in New York, with Jordan Weissman and Kathy O'Neill. We're coming to them in a second, but I have to give you a teaser about what's coming up. We have the biggest, most important finance book of the week, Stress Test by Tim Geithner. We all read it, or at least a few pages of it. It's very big. We're also going to talk about Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, and the fact that she's not going to be giving this commencement speech at Smith College this week. And we're also going to be talking about another bit of the education world, which is student loans and the fact that they seem to be very good at stopping people from buying houses. And at the end, as ever, we will have a lightning numbers round. I know that Kathy's number is 72. I don't know if that's a reference to the number of hours in 3 days or what we're about to find out. So let me introduce her. Kathy, the former hedge fund quant who's now a watchdog of all things Tim Geithner related. Welcome.
Hi, Felix.
And, of course, Jordan Weissman, known to the entire world as the Moneybox columnist at Slate.
The entire world.
The entire world. But first, before we talk about Tim Geithner or Christine Lagarde or anything else, we have an update on last week's podcast where we talked about the planned IPO of the Chinese company Alibaba. And during the podcast, our intrepid producer attempted to buy something off Alibaba and didn't have a huge amount of success. But already we have the best listeners. We love you, listeners. And one of them, Nick Sage, is a student at Portland State University. And he wrote in to let us know that he buys things pretty easily. Get this on AlibabaExpress.com. Not Alibaba.com, but AlibabaExpress.com. This is geared to individual shoppers instead of the bulk deals that we managed to find last week.
The reason why I went there is because I collect toys. I'm a toy collector. And so there's a lot of stuff in China that is just easier to get in China and actually cheaper even when you add the shipping fees. And so I finally just broke down and bought like a little $25 purchase and it worked fine and I've been doing it ever since.
That was Nick Sage. Thank you very much. Go ahead and buy cheap things from China on AlibabaExpress.com or I guess just at your local Walmart.
So wait, does this mean we're not getting the bulk sweatshirts that we were promised?
I think, sadly, that the Slate Money hoodies might need to get put on the back burner for the time being. Although you never know, if we get a sponsor for this show, anything is possible.
You're breaking my heart, Felix. Breaking it.
In any case, we're going to start with Tim Geithner. We have here in the studio a signed copy of Stress Test. It is a huge book. Big and heavy and 580 pages long and $35. Kathy, what is going on here?
Well, Tim Geithner wrote this book and it came out on Monday. And if for people who don't, who've been dead for the last 10 years, let me just mention that Tim Geithner was head of the New York Fed during the credit crisis and he helped bail out a bunch of banks. He helped orchestrate that. And then he was brought in by Obama to be the Treasury Secretary in 2009 after TARP.
Jordan, what did you think of this book so far?
So, you know, my initial reaction to it was sort of just on a human level. I found it I found it just kind of intriguing, the character kind of Geithner creates for himself, or creates of himself.
Do you think this is a character, or do you think this is him?
Oh, this is absolutely a... I mean, you know, I think it's absolutely... Any memoir is a character, right? I mean, especially when you're a public figure. But, you know, I used to live in Washington, and I lived in Washington in 2009, and I would walk by the Treasury on a number of evenings late at night and coming home from work. And a lot of time I would see the third floor light, like one or two lights on the third floor. And I'd sort of imagine that Tim Geithner was in there alone, just banging his head on the desk. Because this was when essentially no nominees could get through Congress. And it turns out I was wrong. What it was Tim Geithner was essentially sitting there getting yelled at by Larry Summers about how we should nationalize the banks. And what one of the things you kind of get from this book, I think, aside from the merits of the policy, is just how threadbare the group of people, you know, the kind of the Treasury was at that point when they were making these massive decisions. And essentially you had this small group of people who had been under siege for months at that point, some of them like Geithner, who were trying to figure out how to save the world and didn't have a lot of, you know, didn't have the ability to bring in a lot of extra hands. And it's just kind of a reflection of this, what a weird moment we were in history.
And part of this is structural. I have to complain as an Englishman in America about the absolutely insane system of the way the civil service is run in this country when you have a switch in parties in the White House. And we managed to switch parties in the White House right in the middle of the worst crisis in living memory. And when that happens, every single senior civil servant gets turfed out. And it takes months for new senior civil servants to come in. And so you have this massive vacuum at the top of Treasury and at the top of every other major government department just when you need everyone working really hard on the problems to hand. Kathy, did you reach that part of the book? Does Timmy talk about that at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, he talks about that in the introduction, in fact. But it's important to keep in mind that he went from the New York Fed to the Treasury. So he didn't actually, you know, we didn't miss him. He was constantly
he
working.
He was the only thing. Him and Bernanke.
Listen, I'm going to make two points about this book because they really have nothing to do with Timmy Geithner, and I don't really care about that guy. But I'm glad to bring up these two points because he brings them up, and Andrew Ross Sorkin did in the profile, and it needs to be said. Namely, the first one is that he just keeps framing it as his story as a success because we didn't lose money on the bailout. And, you know, first of all, that's an absolute, you know, tautological statement because we had the power, when I say we, I mean Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, to make sure that we could not lose money because we just propped up the banks and we did all these things and we're continuing to do those things through the Fed quantitative easing program. So we cannot lose money. So it's actually completely...
Is that true? Because I seem to recall a lot of bank bailout programs in many countries, including the U.S. with the S&L crisis, which did not make money.
That's because we let banks fail back then. But now we don't. And now, like, the whole point of this book is I will not let any banks fail. I will prop them up until they are successful. I will inject capital until that's true. And that brings me to the second point, which is it's an ironic title. He calls the book Stress Test. But when he describes what he meant when he developed these stress tests at the Treasury, they actually meant a test for banks to show that they were solvent. But they were, by construction, allowed to value their mortgage-backed securities, the toxic securities that were making them insolvent. They were allowed to value them at much higher prices than the market would actually bear at that time. So by definition, by construction, they were lying. And even Larry Summers made that point, like, hey, you're actually letting them lie. And Tim Geithner's response in the book, he even says it, is, oh, well, let's let the stress test tell us whether the banks are okay. You know, so it was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay, hang on a sec, yeah. Kathy. Surely, in the grand scheme of things, and this is Tim Geithner's argument, but I can't say I completely disagree with him on it. What you're saying is a defense. It's basically exactly what he's saying. He's saying we have the power to rescue the banks. We have the power to make sure they're not insolvent, to declare them solvent. We can make sure that no more banks fail after Lehman and that the economy doesn't collapse. If you have that power as Treasury Secretary, do you not have to use it?
Well, and that's what I want to – now I want to move on to Tim Geithner himself. The thing about Tim Geithner is he claims to be profoundly unqualified for every job he took. He says that in the book. And there are certain things that you just believe when people say them. Like you ask somebody, how, on a scale of 1 to 10, how sexual are you? And they say 4. You're like, I believe you. And nobody would say that if they weren't a 4. Similarly, Tim Geithner is like, I was unqualified for this, but I somehow got this job. Then I was unqualified for, and then Larry Summers loved me, so he promoted me. And, you know, I mean, I can't help read this and think to myself, oh, this is what white male privilege looks like. This is how it feels. I mean, the truth of the matter is, because he didn't have any economics training, he'd never really understood banking, I don't think. There's no evidence that he did. He only had this binary, narrow view of the world. And it was the either or. Either we preserve the banking system as it is in exactly this form with bonuses and everything, or the world ends. And he never thought beyond that. He, you know, you mentioned that Larry Summers wanted to nationalize the banks, but it's like Tim Geithner had no capacity to have the third option in his head.
Well, so I do think his repeating how underqualified he was is part of his constructing this character, where he tries throughout the book to make himself a little bit more relatable. There's a lot of cursing, you know, there's a lot of profanity. You know, he refers to his speech about how his first like grand appearance in front of Congress just sucked. Like that's his word, the speech sucked. And I think there's a lot of kind of false, humility there, but you know, I mean, his grand theory throughout this book is essentially that banking is a confidence game, which is not too innovative. But I think that, you know, maybe he didn't have the capacity to think for that third option. But I do think he makes a strong argument that at least if you do show this overwhelming force and you do, you know, sit there and say, I'm going to back everything, you can at least stop a run. And that's what he specialized in. It was stopping runs.
Yeah, so this is clear. I think we're agreed on this, that he felt that it was very important to preserve the banking system. He did everything he could to preserve the banking system. He succeeded. And he did so at very little cost to the U.S. taxpayer.
Oh, well, I was going to agree with you up till that last line, which is, you know, it's not about the money so much, it's about the risk we now have. And risk, when you take it on, which we still have, the taxpayer, we are still backing the banks. That can cost money in the future. So depending on how you value...
This is known as moral hazard. And sadly, we don't have a huge amount of time to discuss moral hazard, but we do get to continue talking about the international financial architecture, because we're going to talk about Christine Lagarde, who is, I think we would probably all agree around this table, a more successful crisis fighter than Tim Geithner in many ways. She's good at creating consensus around doing things where she needs to get 15 different European countries to agree with her and get on the same page rather than just one president, which is obviously harder. Anyway, so Christine Lagarde was invited to give the commencement speech this year at Smith College, which is this college up in Massachusetts. And 494 students got very upset about this. And they said that she runs this, the International Monetary Fund. The International Monetary Fund is somehow vaguely big and evil, and we don't like it. And therefore, it's unconscionable that she be invited. So she basically got uninvited and replaced. You couldn't make this up. She got replaced by this woman, Ruth Simmons, who was on the board of Goldman Sachs between 2000 and 2010, just when it was in the height of the credit boom, when it was taking on all of these risks. This is the woman who was in charge of paying Lloyd Blankfein $69 million in 2007 when he was bringing on all of the risks. Kathy, what on earth is going on here?
Well, you know, my theory about sexism and women and et cetera is that, you know, we know sexism is gone when women get to be as shitty as men. And you know, so I'd like to move on past like this question of should Smith students appreciate a powerful woman even if she's kind of an asshole? I mean, if you look at what Lagarde said about Greeks, about the Greek tax, you know, oh, if you guys want to help, just pay your tax. You know, she's very unsympathetic. She's very, you know, she's a typical IMF person, and you say consensus, but IMF really is technocratic. When you say consensus, you mean among other technocrats, not certainly not among people. And I think the Smith College students were responding to that. They're saying, yes, we want, you know, role models, but that she's not our role model just because she has a vagina.
Can I come to Lagarde's somewhat defense, which is, yeah, I do find this kind of ironic that of all the people to have headed the IMF, she's the one getting, you know, tossed out of a commencement, you know, event. The IMF is, in the last few years at least, kind of moved back to the left in a lot of ways. It's come out against austerity. It's talking about inequality. This is you know, these are small steps a lot of our standards, but it's a big step for this institution that it's really associated with the Washington Consensus. You know, fiscal
propriety associated
and such.
To come back to Tim Geithner, you know, he worked at the IMF for a couple of years, and more or less covers them in the space of about two paragraphs in this book. He doesn't spend much time on that period of his career, but he does say that he hated it, basically, and that it's just an unbelievably sluggish and bureaucratic place to work, and that it's much less fun. He uses the word fun to work than Treasury, which, you know, kind of gives you an idea. And I have to say, back to what you were saying, Jordan, about how this is a persona and he's being, you know, falsely modest, I don't think so. I think this is actually him. I've met Tim Geithner a few times. He's a guileless individual. He actually does believe all of the modest things that he says about himself. And he loves talking about how he's not a politician, how he can't talk in public, how he can't communicate big ideas. And he knows this is a big weakness of himself. And I think he's genuinely much more aware of his weaknesses than he is of whatever strengths he might have.
So what you're saying is that he's so good at constructing this character in this memoir because actually it's just him. He's not working that hard to construct anything.
Or he's been constructing this character for many years. None of this came as any surprise to me after having spoken to him over the years.
So, I mean, am I wrong to think that, you know, protesting someone like Lagarde is sort of very 1999 of Smith College, that they're essentially, or do you think that am I giving the IMF too much credit here?
I'm going to foreshadow our third discussion about student debt to make the point that colleges and universities have become increasingly commercial. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a response to the cynical choices that colleges and universities make for their commencement speakers and for their trustees. I just found out, side notes, as we're doing side notes, Ina Drew is now a trustee of Barnard College. Ina Drew of the CIO office for the London Whale.
Who was forced to resign in disgrace from J.P. Morgan.
Exactly. So my point is that, you know, who actually chooses the commencement speakers, the trustees? And why do we choose trustees? For money. This whole thing is about money.
And just to close the circle here, Christine Lagarde was getting paid $35,000 to give this speech, which is not bad for a speech, really.
No. It's probably not Tim Geithner rates.
And it does show, and I'm going to use this to segue into the third part of the podcast here, it does show what's happening to the costs in higher education. That graduates of most big, famous liberal arts colleges kind of expect to be given a fun time at their commencement. And that's the least of the costs that the colleges incur. Obviously, we're seeing massive inflation in the amount that the administrators are getting paid. The students are getting much more lavish accommodations. There are climbing walls all over the place. And somehow, you put all of this together and you get massive cost inflation in universities, a result of which, is massive student loan inflation. Student loans are increasing way, way faster than any other form of debt in the country. And they're a huge burden on an entire generation of Americans. So, Jordan, what is the latest consequence of this that we've just discovered?
So there's been this ongoing discussion about you know, what is student loan debt going to do to Gen Y economically, to the millennials financially? You know, we're the first generation to essentially graduate up to our eyeballs in student debt, and that's actually a technical term. Up to your eyeballs is a certain threshold.
How much debt do you have, Jordan?
I'm not going to say publicly. I'll say between my fiance and I, we have a sizable debt to deal with. But it's and so, you know, this is a it's kind of uncharted territory, right? It's never been this broad, and the debt has never been distributed this broadly, and the debt burdens have never been this big. So you're starting to get groups like the New York Federal Reserve Bank of New York, for instance, researching the effects on things like whether or not young people are buying houses. And this week they came out with their second, now it's becoming an annual report, on you know, the difference in mortgage applications between essentially between people who have student debt and young people who don't have student debt. And what they found is that before the recession, if you had student loans, you were also more likely to take out a mortgage. Now, if you have student loans, you're less likely. And this is, you know, one of the data points that people are starting to use to say student debt is actually holding back the recovery.
Because what we need in good Tim Geithner fashion here for a strong recovery is more people taking out more debt to buy more houses, right?
Well, yeah. So we want, you know, it's really hard to have a recovery without a housing recovery. And I thought that was actually one of the weakest points of Geithner's book, just to go back to that. He actually writes off housing's effect on the – and basically excuses the very weak mortgage modification programs the Obama administration created, and saying they wouldn't have helped that much anyway, even if they were more successful, which I thought
– Thank you very much. And I, by the way, I wanted to mention that I searched – I have the Kindle version of the book for – you know, because I couldn't remember seeing it, but I searched for robo-signing, never mentioned. The guy does not acknowledge the perverse incentives of HAMP, of the housing modification.
Meanwhile, I, you know, since we're digressing down Timmy shaped paths here throughout the entire podcast, I did a search on the word confidence, and it appears 150 times in the book, and then another 5 times in the index. So and no matter where you are in the financial cycle, this appears constantly throughout the book. Geithner wants to be improving confidence. Yep. And that's all he – and
yes.
Confidence is, of course, as we've said already, a synonym for banker's bonuses, I think.
Yes. And he never actually learns how the market actually works, by the way. That's another one of my pet peeves. But let me go back to the student debt issue. It's in both cases, Tim Geithner and the student debt issue, in some sense, we're trying to solve the wrong problem. Mm-hmm. Tim Geithner is trying to solve the problem of confidence without actually solving the structural problems. And in the student debt stuff, we're trying to solve the problem of students not also getting mortgage debt, when in fact, we should probably try to address why colleges are costing more and more.
I agree with that about 65% of the way, maybe 70% of the way. And let me tell you why.
I'm so glad you can quantify so finely.
Yeah, I'm masterful at that. But the whereas I had up to my eyeballs in debt before. But what the reason why I disagree a little is, yes, the fundamental challenge is the cost of college, no question, and finding a way to rein that in. However, there's this secondary issue, which is this problem with students paying back their loans and kind of the bizarre system that we have for student debt repayment involving all these loan servicers like Sallie Mae and, you know, private companies that don't necessarily always have the best intentions and debt collectors and whatnot. And coming back to this, you know, whether or not people with student loans buy houses issue, if you look at students who are current on their debt, they are no less likely, in fact, they're more likely to take out a mortgage than other young adults. If you look at students who are behind on their debt or delinquent, they're the ones who don't take out mortgages at all. And there's a growing number of delinquent students out there. And the thing about delinquencies and defaults in student debt is it's not always because the debts are so huge or because they are so hard or because they have, you know, such low incomes. Often it's because of this horrible debt repayment system we have. And so if we could reform that in some substantive way and their ideas for that, then maybe, you know, some people wouldn't have their finances ruined.
Let me give you another perspective.
Sure.
It didn't actually say, the articles that I looked at this week didn't actually explain whether the people who aren't taking out mortgages actually applied for mortgages and were rejected.
Well, they're not going to apply for mortgages if they're delinquent on their student loans,
well,
because they know they're not
right.
going to be
so
given
me,
the loan.
So let me try to make a suggestion for what's actually going – one of the things that's actually going on, which is that the black students' enrollment went up by 35% between 2003 and 2009, but most of that enrollment was for for-profit companies, for-profit colleges, I should say. Those students often don't graduate. So that might be one reason.
Absolutely.
They take on debt but don't graduate. Mm-hmm. And you can see why they won't have a job to pay back their student loans. And moreover, $32 billion went from the United States government to for-profit colleges in the form of student loan grants. All I'm trying to say is this isn't happening to everyone equally. The student debt crisis is happening to certain populations more. And that money is going to private for-profit colleges who are predatory.
Kids, don't go to for-profit colleges. It's a bad idea. You probably won't graduate and you'll just wind up saddled with a whole bunch of debt which you can't discharge even in bankruptcy.
Nope. Can't do it.
I just wanted to also mention that, you know, the University of Phoenix parent company was the biggest buyer of Google ads for one of the quarters in 2013. So it's not like it is a minor issue. This is a huge issue.
Can we go back one more time down the Timothy Geithner rabbit hole? So there's this thing about, again, coming back to the persona at the beginning of the book, is he does this, and the unqualified thing, right? He spends a lot of time talking about how he wasn't a very good student and how he didn't grow up that privileged. And, you know, he's just like, oh, you know, my parents were, you know, they worked for nonprofits around the world. And, you know, I went to these, you know, American schools and wherever, India and whatnot. And I just kind of wanted to scream the entire time, because while he was, you know, kind of pulling the humility card, he was outlining a childhood in which he was the son of a family who were important, you know, global development workers. The father had gone to Dartmouth. He ended up going to Dartmouth himself, probably on legacy, able to go to grad school for a while.
He actually mentions his guilt feelings about getting in as a legacy to Dartmouth.
Yeah. Oh, it's right. He does. But then, you know, he goes back to the, oh, well, you know, but then he tries to do a thing at the beginning where he's like, oh, I wasn't really that privileged.
He does say that he had an unbelievably privileged lifestyle, you know, especially when you're in places like India or Indonesia.
Well, he said he felt the gap between American standards of living and you know, foreign standards of living.
Certainly, what growing up in abroad does is it makes you feel alienated from the sort of WASPy establishment when you come back. And I think that's undeniable.
I do want to add, though, that, you know, he spends so much time in this book talking about how he doesn't care that much about money, but he cares so much about power. He, you know, it's like power porn. He remembers every word that President Bush or Obama said to him, or Larry Summers, for that matter. The guy is, you know, some people like money, some people like power.
On which note, we are going to wrap up with the numbers of the week. And I know that Kathy has 72, so I'm going to wait even longer to find out what that means. Jordan, what's yours?
35% or negative 35%, which is how much less the government now gives in transfer payments to a single mother family or a single parent family that lives under 50% of the poverty line compared to the 1980s. There was some research that recently came out just showing essentially how the entire safety net has shifted from the very poorest Americans over to the moderately poor, which has a lot to do with the end of welfare as we know it during Clinton and whatnot. And it just kind of a reminder that we now support the people who don't quite need it the absolute most at the expense of the people who do sometimes.
So just to be clear here, if you're a single mother with getting welfare payments, those payments today are 35% lower than they were when?
In the 80s.
Okay.
In inflation-adjusted dollars.
Okay. My number is 100,000. This is, I think, going to be a theme of this week's podcast. quick quiz between you two. Do either of you know who Phil Taubman is? Does that name ring any bells?
No.
It sounds like he might be like a prog rock musician or something.
Phil Taubman was the guy who took over from Jill Abramson as Washington bureau chief of the New York Times.
Couldn't have been more right.
$100,000 is the amount that Phil Taubman got paid over and above what Jill Abramson got paid for doing exactly the same job of Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, which I think needs no further commentary. What does your 72 refer to, Kathy?
My 72 is yet another plunge down the toilet of Tim Geithner,
I thought we were done with Timmy.
Which is the number of times he used the phrase moral hazard in his book, and almost every single time was a dismissive, if not derisive, mention of the people that were Old Testament vengeance fundamentalists, moral hazard fundamentalists, basically dismissing anyone's concern that what we're doing might be the wrong thing to do.
This podcast has been brought to you by Crown Books, publisher of Stress Test by Timothy Geithner, available at all good bookstores for $35 or probably even less on Amazon. I promise no Geithner next week, and don't hold me to that promise. That's it for this edition of Slate Money. Do write to us with your comments, kudos, complaints, and anything, everything at slatemoney@slate.com. The producers for Slate Money are Stan Alcorn and Tracy Samuelson. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For Kathy O'Neill and Jordan Weissman, I'm Felix Salmon. We'll talk to you again next week on Slate Money.